Pippa Hudson. Lines are always open on 021-446-0567.
Welcome back, and it's time for Consumer Talk. Our consumer watchdog, Wendy Nola, joining us from a studio in Durban. Always lovely to have you with us, Wendy. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Pippa. Hello to you and the listeners.
Now, we're going to be talking disclaimers this week. I wonder how many listeners like me have had to sign that disclaimer when you drop your child off to do some or other activity or send them on a trip somewhere, and you feel like you're signing away your rights as a parent, signing away their responsibility in looking after your child. Maybe you're the person who's had to sign them away when you've gone scuba diving or climbing something or anything that's vaguely carrying some kind of risk. Today, we'll be asking what purpose those forms actually serve and whether we have any right to refuse them. That's going to be in the first part of the show, and then just a reminder that the second half hour after 1:30 is an open line where you're welcome to call in on absolutely any consumer issue whatsoever. The number to dial 021-446-0567, or you can send us an SMS or voice note. Please keep them to the issue of disclaimers in the first half hour. Anything goes after 1:30. Over to you, Wendy.
Okay, so as you said, I'm sure we've all had a moment where we've been asked to sign a form that includes a disclaimer that leaves us feeling very uncomfortable and not a little anxious. Mm. So something along the lines of, we indemnify the organization from liability arising from any injury or harm related to anything that they do or they don't do arising out of any kind of circumstance. So that naturally, that seems a bit like legally exonerating them from anything they could do to us or our children, even if they are negligent in some way. And it doesn't sit well, obviously. So yeah. Today we're going to chat to a specialist attorney for her view on disclaimers, the legal situation. But before we get there, let's start with what made us think of doing this show this week. Mm. And a particular email from Keith. And he wrote, I hope you can get someone who can give us our rights on disclaimers. My son wants to go to a school camp in December, but I must sign a disclaimer form before he can go. What are my rights if something happens to him while he's there? Or is the law on the school side because I signed the disclaimer? And what about all the other disclaimers we see every day? Park at own risk, enter at own risk, etc. What are our rights?
Some very important questions there, Keith, obviously for parents in particular, but for all of us navigating those spaces where we're asked to sign away those rights. So thanks so much for broaching the subject for us today, and hopefully we can get you some answers over the course of the next couple of minutes. Wendy, I know you're often asked from a consumer perspective whether indemnities like that comply with the Consumer Protection Act. Does it say anything about disclaimers?
Okay, our legal expert's going to give the full story, but in brief, the CPA has not outlawed indemnities completely, but what it does do is restrict companies in the way that they can draw up these disclaimers or indemnities and how they can enforce them. So in short, companies are within their rights to indemnify themselves against certain liabilities as long as they notify consumers properly, first of all. But the CPA also states that unfair exclusion clauses, those that seek to exempt a company from liability for losses caused by gross negligence, for example, or are excessively one-sided against the consumer, will not be upheld. And it also says, hooray, that the disclaimer must be in plain and understandable language, and the consumer must be given adequate opportunity to receive or to see or be given a sight of the disclaimer and to comprehend what it is that they are signing or agreeing to by entering the premises or signing a form or whatever.
Okay, so it is covered to a degree in the CPA. We're going to find out now from a specialist attorney where that leaves us as the people signing those disclaimers. On the line is Trudy Brookman, who's a CPA specialist attorney. Trudy, it's lovely to have you back with us again. Welcome back.
Hi, Pippa. Thanks so much for having me.
You heard Wendy read out Keith's email about the disclaimer for his son's school camp in December, and you've heard her give us a brief summary of what the Act says. But essentially, what are Keith's rights in this particular circumstance?
Great stuff. Let me launch right in. Just to start by saying, a disclaimer and an exemption of liability, a limitation of liability or an indemnity, all of those legal terms mean approximately the same thing. They have approximately the same legal effect, and that means that in our context, the supplier will not pay out damages if the consumer or his kids or any of his dependents suffer any harm or loss. So The basic rule in our law is that we must enforce contracts that parties have freely agreed to. But in our law, there's an appreciation that often the consumer has really limited negotiating room with regard to some of these disclaimers, exemptions, and indemnities. So before the CPA, before the Consumer Protection Act came in, we had a situation, for example, in one of the cases that was decided before the Supreme Court of Appeal, Durban's Water Wonderland versus Mrs. Buerta and her daughter, who were injured when a ride at the Water World malfunctioned. Mm-hmm. They were not able to claim any of their damages, or they were not awarded any of their damages, because of a disclaimer that was put up at the ticket office at Durban's Water World. So now, thankfully, we're in the post-CPA era since March 2011. We have the Consumer Protection Act in place, and this overrules the old common law rules that applied at Durban Water World, and also whatever is in a contract. And the purpose of the CPA is to protect vulnerable consumers. So what the rules are is that the Consumer Protection Act requires for an exclusion of liability that it needs to be fair, reasonable, and just toward the consumer. So we're not just looking at the supplier's interest. It has to be fair, reasonable, and just toward the consumer. That's quite hard to evaluate, isn't it? Because it doesn't feel fair or reasonable or just if you take your car to the to the garage, when you come and collect it, hopefully properly repaired tomorrow, they say, oh, we had a burglary overnight, and sorry, we're not liable because you you brought your car to us at own risk and it's been stolen overnight. Mm. That's a recent case that we had, Mercurius Motors versus Lopez. The further requirement from the CPA is that the clause also needs to be written in plain language, as Wendy has mentioned. Plain language means that a person with average literacy skills in South Africa, that's probably around grade 8, let's say, can understand it fully. And it needs to be drawn to the attention of the consumer, along with an explanation of what the effect is of this clause. So it can't just say that you send your child on the school camp at own risk. It needs to explain that if your child is hurt or killed on the school camp or his possessions are stolen, then the school will not pay you out for the harm that your kid has suffered. That it needs to be as simply and clearly explained the way that I've done it now. The alternative is, if it's not properly drawn to the attention of the consumer, if it's not fair, reasonable, and just, and it's not in plain language, then the clause will be void. In other words, invalid. The school will still have to pay out the damages or the garage or whatever the supplier is in the scenario.
Okay. Trudy, who makes the assessment of where the liability lies and who has been fair and reasonable and just, if it's brought into question?
That's the hardest question in the whole world. Well, our courts are tasked with that. But most of these cases, in fact, we haven't had a case where, since the CPA has come into effect, a particular disclaimer has been evaluated by the courts. The legal wheels turn very slowly, sadly. So there's also the National Consumer Tribunal, which is tasked with dealing with issues between consumers and suppliers. They've also not issued any rulings with regard to disclaimers, as far as I know, but they're probably a bit of a quicker route to go if there is a big dispute between you as a consumer and a supplier. There's also the Consumer Goods and Services Ombud. They're based in Centurion. I think they're great, and under certain circumstances, they will also have the jurisdiction to be able to decide something like that.
Okay, sorry to have a difficult question, but thanks for the comprehensive answer. Wendy, any other questions for Trudy?
Yes, I would like, Trudy, if you will, to just talk a little bit about where gross negligence fits in, because it ties in with a case study that I dealt with a couple of years ago, post-CPA, in terms of it obviously falls under what is fair, reasonable, and just towards the consumer. So if there was gross negligence, if you could just talk about in as simply as you, simple language as you can, what more or less constitutes gross negligence?
Great, let's launch into that. So So the basic principle is that you can, as a supplier, you can contract out of liability for negligence. In other words, you can have one of these disclaimers and say, I won't be liable if I've been negligent. But our law says, and the CPA confirms this, that you can't contract out of liability for gross negligence. So it's quite hard in law to find exactly where the line sits between negligence and gross negligence. Mm. Negligence is where you could have foreseen that harm could have been caused to this person, and you could have prevented it, but you didn't do that. Gross negligence is where there's, let's call it, a conscious or voluntary disregard for the requirement to use proper care to prevent the harm to the person or their property. So it's fairly extreme conduct when you compare it with ordinary negligence, where you just didn't exercise reasonable care. This is specifically not exercising the reasonable care that we really can expect from you.
Okay, if that's, I could, very well explained.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So if I could make up an example, Trudy, the helicopter pilot who decides that they're going to cut corners and cut costs by extending the amount of months in between the services and replacement of parts that are meant to be replaced on a regular basis, they've made a conscious decision to take that risk, knowing what the consequence could be. Would that be something that would constitute gross negligence?
Yes. Certainly. I know of an incident where we had, a school bus that went off the road and into a gorge, Neisner sort of area a few years ago. In that case, they found at the inquest that one of the bus company's employees had taken that particular bus for its roadworthy certificate and had decided to rather pass some money under the table because he was under time pressure to get the bus back. So he got a fraudulent roadworthy certificate, didn't bother to do any of the repairs that had been pointed out. That's definitely gross negligence.
And there are several crosses on a bridge in Renendal that pay tribute to it. Yeah, very, very sad example. Interesting question that's come in from Errol on our WhatsApp, or a comment from Errol rather, saying it's actually unlawful to not allow a learner to go on a school outing if the parent refused to sign the indemnity form. Is Errol correct?
I don't know the answer to that. Do you, Wendy?
No, I don't. Just repeat it.
Errol saying it's not lawful to forbid the learner to go on the school outing because their parent hasn't signed the indemnity form. Errol, I know, is someone who has a great deal of experience in the schooling environment and is very active as a member of school governing bodies, etc. So I'm inclined to believe his comments when they relate to schooling. Yeah.
It does.
I would
have thought it's quite disturbing.
Right. Yes.
Okay. Wendy?
Yeah. No, I'm sorry, maybe I've misunderstood. Is he saying that even if the parent doesn't sign the disclaimer, the child can still go?
He seems to be suggesting that is the case, that the school is not allowed to not take that child because the parent, on the grounds that the parent didn't sign the form.
Well, it does beg the question, why bother to get the parent to sign the disclaimer in the first place if it's not going to make any difference to whether the child goes or not?
Really
absolutely, but what suppliers often do, and I think their lawyers often recommend that to them, a disclaimer has a deterrent effect on claims. So even where the disclaimer isn't necessarily valid, many consumers would not bother to make a claim because they know that they've signed a disclaimer or an exemption or an indemnity clause. Consumers really shouldn't necessarily be deterred by these things. Just get some proper legal advice and find out whether this thing you've signed, if you were forced to sign it, was valid. What I do in cases where I'm absolutely forced to sign one of those things, I'm a great scratcher out of onerous provisions in contracts being a lawyer, where they refer to me. But where you are forced to sign something like that, don't read it before you sign it so that you can argue after the fact that you didn't appreciate what you were signing.
That is
okay. That's classic.
That's the advice for the day.
My goodness. So do your advice is not to read the small print.
that's a first.
Something, yeah. Trudy, an interesting question just popped in on the SMS line asking whether you're allowed to cross out individual clauses within an agreement like this. And it's a great question. Thank you, whoever it was who sent that through. Can you simply say, well, I'm prepared to sign the disclaimer, but not clause 1.3b, part 3?
Absolutely. Of course you can. The purpose of a contract is that we have two parties with equal negotiating power who can decide to agree on certain aspects and decide to not agree on other aspects, and the aspects that they don't agree on are not part of the contract, and you're not bound by that. So absolutely, everyone should be signing contracts with a red pen in the hand and scratching out everything that you're not comfortable with.
Obviously, can I jump in there, Trudy?
Ideal world, sometimes yes. One is forced to sign if you want the service or the product.
Well, that's the thing. That's the point I wanted to just make. We're going to let you go before the news. I just want to mention this quickly. A case that I'm going to get to was one that came to me a few years ago, but post-CPA, where a father, again, a parental situation, a father had to admit the daughter to a private hospital, and one of the few who actually read through all the terms and conditions and was horrified by about four of them. And so he scratched them out, as you suggest, and of course it was brought to the attention of a manager, and the manager said, it's as simple as this: if you want us to admit your child, you have to sign we do not allow any scratching out. And I'll get to some of the one clause in particular which was particularly horrific. So he chose, it was a routine not a particularly risky procedure that this child was going to have, but still it irked him no end. But I would imagine that that other private hospitals would take a similar view.
I'd expect so. Where the Consumer Protection Act applies, it will overrule even a clause that you have signed.
Right. That's what my advice was, yeah.
Okay, so the CPA would overrule that. Okay.
If there was gross negligence or something, they wouldn't be able to stand by that disclaimer.
Absolutely. You also can't exempt yourself from liability for breach of contract, and a hospital is under contract as well to provide proper services to their patients.
Right, got it.
It's so important to have this kind of information, I think, revisited. Trudy, I want to thank you for being with us because, contracts, I think, Trudy, a lot of people think they've signed a contract, that's it, it's cast in stone, they've attached their name to it, and that is that. And meanwhile, if provisions within that contract were actually illegal, for example, employment contracts, I don't know how many times I've heard an HR practitioner utter the words, you cannot contract out of the provisions of Basic Employment Act. I think it's really important what you're doing, trying to educate people that they do have the right to question what is in those documents.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. The tricky part is that the sort of fees that you have to pay an attorney to find that out, most South Africans can't afford, and I suppose that's part of the injustice of life. But there are various other avenues which one can consult free of charge. There's always legal aid, and you can speak to various ombuds, and there are various other systems of finding out what your rights are. It's worthwhile checking.
Quick one before we let you go, Trudy. Adrian's just SMS'd asking, going back to that example of the car that it's stolen from the repair centre, Adrian asks, would my insurance still pay if my car was stolen from somebody else's repair centre? You're not an insurance specialist, but as a legal person, what would your view be, Trudy?
Generally, there shouldn't be an issue. The issue is for the insurance to pay. In order to give a proper answer, I'd obviously have to read the policy in respect of the particular vehicle. But in principle, there's no reason that the insurance wouldn't cover you for that. But many people drive cars around that only have third-party insurance, etc.
Okay, so again, it would depend on the kind of insurance you had, Adrian, whether you'd be covered properly or not. Trudy, it's been wonderful speaking to you again. Thank you so much for joining us on the show this afternoon.
Big pleasure. You take it.
You too. Trudy.
Thanks,
Brookman.
Trudy.
Trudy's a CPA specialist attorney. CPA, of course, being the Consumer Protection Act. And Wendy, I mean, I've been reading the clause that particular parent at the hospital found so irksome. And I think it's worth reading it out for our audience after the news headlines, just to give them a sort of sense of the kind of thing that needs to be challenged and questioned when we are presented with these documents. So we'll do that after 1:30, and then we'll move into our general consumer section. So if you've got a question on disclaimers, you can still phone in, but if you've got a consumer issue around anything else, call us now on 021-446-0567.
Cape Talk. Cape Talk. WhatsApp Pippa now on 072-567-1567.
We continue our consumer talk with Wendy Nola and Robert and Takai and Alistair in Lakeside. I'll come to your calls in just a moment. But before we move away from disclaimers, Wendy, you were talking about that case of the father who didn't want to sign the disclaimer in the hospital. I was just interested to know how that case resolved itself in the end. Did he have to sign or did he simply take her to another hospital?
No, he did sign because, as I said, it was a fairly minor, I forget what it was, tonsils or something, mm-hmm. pretty minor, and he didn't. He chose to let it go, but he forwarded it to me to just, you know, to raise the point about disclaimers. Is that the one you wanted me to read out?
Yes, I mean, I'm just staggered that a hospital can have a statement saying that neither you nor any other person will have any claim for any injuries which the patient suffers in any circumstances.
No, quite horrific indeed, and you can understand why he refused to sign it. I think it's fair to say that most of us wouldn't actually, you know, you're in the admission process. Most of us wouldn't read the pages and pages of small print, but he did read clause 2.3, and this is what it said. I'm just summarizing it a bit. Neither the hospital nor their directors, officers, employees, or agents will be liable for any injury or any harm that the patient or the dependent, etc., may suffer or sustain, regardless of how this arises, and you indemnify the releasees, them, against any such claims which you may make. This means that neither you nor any other person will have any claim for any injuries which the patient suffers in any circumstances. It also means that if you do claim, and notwithstanding this disclaimer, we are required to make a payment to you, you will in turn reimburse us that payment.
Staggering. I mean, to take it to its absolutely most blatant, broadest level, that means if a doctor shows up drunk and accidentally amputates the wrong leg, sorry for you, we're not
sorry
liable.
And if you go to court and get a settlement, then sorry, but you'll have to pay that to us.
It's remarkable.
It's just, and it sits there, and I bet you, maybe we should do a follow-up show on this, I bet you if I looked at the admissions forms for a number of hospitals, we'd find something similarly horrific. This was post-CPA a few years ago, but definitely within the CPA era. So again, as we discussed with Trudy before the news, you know, that's not going to help them if the wrong limb gets amputated because the surgeon's drunk or whatever. If it is gross negligence, that clause is completely null and void, and they, you know, they would have a right to take legal action, etc. So yeah, but that's an extreme one. And as I say, I doubt that it's a one-off. There must be many others of those that are just sitting in there, waiting to trip people up or not if it came to it, but shouldn't be there in the first place.
Okay, thanks for that interesting topic. And Keith, again, thanks for raising it with your email. We're going to move on to the open line session. Get calling now on 021-446-0567 with any consumer query you might have. We're going to start with Alistair in Lakeside, who wants to talk about the dreaded footstoots clause. Alistair, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I'd really like some clarification, please, on what legal grounds I have when it comes to a second-hand car. Just very briefly, Tosi, I bought a car in May. It was a very late model. It had low mileage. It was very, very well kept. But I'd only had it a couple of days when it started leaking from the gearbox. It was repaired. It had to go back again and have that repaired again. My mechanic had a look at my car, and he said, hang on, your back shock absorbers are both going.
Oh.
So I thought I had a six-month, a six-month, and so that would make it November, a period where those sort of things had to be attended to. So I take it back, and they all of them look very vague, and the floor manager says, no, it's a very gray area. No, but we can't do that. Now, what sort of, what is the truth about this consumer protection thing? Nobody seems to know.
Great question, Alistair.
Okay, so private deals are exempt from CPA. Was this a private deal, or did you buy the vehicle from?
No, it was bought from a very reputable car dealer.
Okay, well, there's no
kind of like, we provide good service, etc.
Okay, no. So if you buy a car, the Consumer Protection Act covers deals between consumers and companies, to put it very simply. So I often get complaints from people who've bought cars off an online site and have had problems, a private sale, and then unfortunately you do have recourse, common law recourse, but that's, as Trudy says, the wheels move turn very slowly, and it's a very expensive process as well. So there's no real practical justice. But when you buy from a dealership, there's no grey area, I'm afraid, as much as that dealership would like you to believe. You have the protection of the Consumer Protection Act for 6 months from the time of sale. And I suppose what he means by grey area is that, you know, it's not as simple as if you buy a toaster and it malfunctions, we'll give you a new one. There are certain sort of more lenient provisions because of the amount of money involved and because the Motor Industry Ombudsman argues that the industry would fall to its knees if, you know, you found a stain on the carpet of a new car and said, I don't want this one, I want a new one. You know, that's not going to work. They are required to repair. But you're not asking for a new car. You're asking for the problems to be rectified.
Yes, right? And especially with shock absorbers, were inferring that I had worn it out. And as I said to them, I've only had this car since May, and it's impossible to wear out shock absorbers in such a short period of time. They go slow, you know, they wear out very slowly.
Exactly.
And so couldn't have. Yeah.
Pulling the wool, I'm afraid, comes to mind.
Yep.
So you need to go back. This is what I suggest. If you go back to them, explain that you know what your rights are, that the CPA requires them to repair. If you get no joy, you have a couple of options. You can go to the Motor Industry Ombudsman. Unfortunately, they are inundated, so it takes a while. Or you could come to me, and I'll do my best to intervene.
Okay, thanks so much.
Alistair, thanks for your call. And if you want to take up the option of contacting Wendy, now's a good time to give out her email address, which is consumer@nola.co.za, spelled KNOWLER, consumer@nola.co.za. Just a reminder to listeners, if you are sending Wendy a question, please pop in the subject line the words Cape Talk and then just a word or two to identify the topic. So, Alistair, you want to say Cape Talk, follow-up footstoots or something like that, so Wendy knows to look out for your email and follow-up for you. Thanks for your call. Robert has been waiting very patiently on the line from Takai to talk to us about banking technology. Robert, good afternoon.
Hi, Pepe. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was rather rudely surprised this morning, actually, when I presented my debit card at a supplier. And instead of entering the PIN code, they simply tapped it across the face of their little card machine. My immediate response was to say, but hold on, surely I need to input a PIN into this. And she told me that it's not necessary. This card had a feature where they could simply tap it, regardless of who presents it, and the transaction would be debited off your account. Concerns me to a very large extent, because SIM cards and PIN protected, which gives me some semblance of security. So anybody could pick up my card and simply walk up to a supplier, tap it.
Oh dear, we've lost Robert, I think, but I got the gist of it. I mean, Wendy, his concern is the card's got a PIN function for a reason, as an extra layer of protection. Should it be able surely being able to pick it up and tap it regardless of the user and without a PIN is circumventing that security feature.
It is absolutely. I forget the name of that, but it is common. I mean, when I visited New Zealand last year, everywhere I went, that's what happened. And in fact, if that facility wasn't working on the machine for some reason, they actually had a little sign apologizing to their customers for the fact that they now had to enter in a PIN. And I remember thinking, oh, I don't know how this is going to work in South Africa, because, you know, we are used to, you know, card fraud is rife.
As it is.
So,
yeah.
I can't. Other than saying that, which is my personal view and that I agree totally with Robert's misgivings, I think what I need to do is take this up with the banking ombudsman, whose name is Rihanna Steyn, and get her views. We could either just report back next week or even invite her onto the show to talk about that. Maybe we could build a show around
banking issues. I think that would be an excellent idea.
So we'll come back on that. My colleague here has informed me that it's called the tap and go.
Okay.
Which is pretty descriptive.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Very important issue you've raised there, Robert. Thank you. Given the huge security holes in our banking industry, I think that's so important. So we'll certainly try and follow up on that for you. I think we've already got a booking next week, but perhaps the week after that, we can try and get something together around banking and get some feedback on that one. In the meantime, Robert, if I were you, keep that card very close to your person and watch it with hawk eyes so that it doesn't grow legs and walk away. Before we get to Craig and Kevin's calls, two interesting comments coming in response to that hospital disclaimer that you read out, Wendy. One is from Gail on the WhatsApp line saying, when my sister had an operation, she actually signed her name as not acceptable under that kind of disclaimer, and nobody picked it up. I guess nobody's reading that carefully. I like her. I like her spunk, though. But then yes. A very valid point from Caroline on the SMS line saying, what the hospital is doing is trying to shift the blame onto the doctors and indemnifying the hospital, which takes no risk. And the result of that is, of course, the doctors have to have such high levels of insurance. And we've spoken several times on this show. I know the obstetricians in particular, the rate of dropout of obstetricians from their profession is staggering because of the skyrocketing malpractice insurance that they have to pay every month.
That's correct.
So
carte blanche covered that. On that point, though, one of the other four clauses which that father crossed out was one that specifically said, we are not responsible for the conduct of our doctors. That clause I read out was about the stuff that the hospital should be responsible for. So the nurses and the clinic staff or anyone, any other form of action that would lead to injury or harm is what they were specifically as the hospital and seeking to indemnify themselves from.
Crazy. Quick one before we move on. Joel asking, if you're going to cross out a line and a disclaimer, do you have to sign next to that crossed out line to say that it was you who did so?
I would recommend that, yes.
You would, okay. Jenny also just sending a WhatsApp to say that similar experience with a medical indemnity at a medical center. When I was confronted with such a form at a center years ago, I crossed out the paragraph about gross negligence before I signed it. So therefore, see, it seems it can be done in some cases. Jenny, thanks for that feedback. Right, let's go to Craig in Paul, wanting to talk about home buying. Craig, good afternoon.
Hi there, good afternoon. Yeah, I'm from Somerset West, so I was just driving to Paul.
Okay.
Anyway, that's besides the point. So we bought a house 6 months ago from a reputable agent in Somerset West, and obviously we had to stipulate on the OTP what needed to be done in terms of the faults that we found, and subsequently 6 months later, these various points that we put on the OTP, well, some of them we've actually fixed because we've had to, and obviously footed the bills for it. But basically, the conveyancing attorneys that were doing it, they basically said that their job is done. There's nothing that they can do. We need to speak to the seller. But surely these things need to be sorted out before a transfer takes place and that type of thing. Is that not right?
Yes. Craig, absolutely. I was about to say that on the agreement, you should have specified or been advised to specify that the transfer was conditional upon all those things being done, because that would certainly exercise the seller's mind in terms of getting it done. They're not going to get the sale, and the agent's not going to get their commission, and none of those nice things are going to happen until they've done what they promised to do. So I'm guessing that wasn't written into the agreement, that it has to be done. If it was an open-ended one, then I'm afraid you are in a bit of trouble with the seller. Was there no time frame or specification around when it needed to be done?
No. I just pretty much thought, you know, by putting it on the OTP before, we just thought, it would be done.
Okay. Well, at this stage, your option is, rather than badgering the seller and appealing to their better nature, I mean, you'd be left to take legal action, which, as we keep saying on this show, is costly and very slow. So I'm sorry I can't be of more help. I mean, what your case does demonstrate, though, is the importance of protecting yourself in the sales agreement. So to make sure that nothing is open-ended and that whatever is conditional, whatever you need doing is conditional upon that it be done before the transfer transfer takes place, and that way the conveyancing attorneys have to take responsibility for it. They can't do the transfer and then wash their hands, because it's in the agreement that it has to be, transfer can only take place when that list of things that need remedying has been done. Mm. So I'm sorry for you, it's an expensive lesson, Craig.
All righty.
Okay, sorry, Craig. Thanks so much for your call, though, and I think important lessons for everyone listening to be a little bit more specific about how
Absolutely.
They phrase those kind of clauses.
Can I just add one very important thing out of a story that I've written recently for the Sunday Times, and that is to look at the clause around the payment of the commission. I had this case where there was a clause that said that basically allowed for the commission to be paid out of the monies paid to the transferring attorney by the would-be buyer. Mm-hmm. The seller cancelled, and the conveyancing attorney took 92,000 rand of the would-be buyer's payment for the house and paid the commission out of it. It's since been reversed. It was a huge story.
Sure.
But always to look for that clause and see, number one, that the defaulting party has to pay, and number two, that the commission will only be paid on transferring of the property. So you protect yourself there. And always, always, if you're buying a property, to spend the 3,000 rand or whatever on it, getting it professionally assessed by someone with engineering qualifications, etc., can save you a nightmare and of all kinds, financial, emotional, etc. It's really worth the money.
Okay.
Check that the roof is sound, that the boundary wall's not going to collapse in a storm, that kind of thing.
Thanks, Wendy. Very, very wise advice. Gosh, that banking program is definitely needed. I've just had a flurry of messages about the tap-and-go technology with various comments, including several people pointing out that there is a limit on the tap-and-go each day. Wayne saying he believes at FNB it's only 200 rand. It's a minimum limit based on the tap-and-go. A few other people here is Lisa saying, I'm so glad Robert brought up that tap and go. It's very concerning to me. I can't understand why it is allowed, because a chain is only as good as its weakest link. But an interesting contribution coming in on our WhatsApp line with a little bit more detail on what it is and how it works, saying the chap who just called in, Ray, tapping cards, with the new tap and go, it's RFID type technology. I did a quick Google, and that's radio frequency identification technology. This person says, I complained to my bank that it wasn't safe and that I didn't want a card that was unsecured. And their response was, sorry, there is no other option. All cards on our RFID tap and go enabled. Definitely one I think we need to follow up on, Wendy.
Absolutely. It is some small comfort, though, that it's on very small purchases.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be able to go and buy a TV, and someone's not going to go and take a card and go and tap it for 6,000 rands worth of booze for your account. You know, it is a small comfort that, but still within the context of South Africa, I'd very much like to get some professional input on that.
Me too. Vic has just emailed to say apparently it has also been introduced they had the same issue in Australia. His brother is in Australia and said the banks ended up paying millions of dollars back to angry clients whose cards had been misused. So interesting to hear we're not alone in having this problem. Vic, thanks so much for that little addition to the conversation. Right, let's go to Elise, who is on the line from Notuk, about contracts and clauses. Elise, good afternoon.
Hi, Pippa. I've just been picking up bits and pieces of the show on my way back from the airport back home to Notuk.
Welcome home.
And I've heard the attorney and a couple of comments of Wendy's, all very interesting. And there's a lot of mention of having to go to legal dispute and legal lawyers in order to sort out certain matters. And I just wanted to raise the option of mediation, facilitated mediation specifically, which is quite different to everybody sitting around a table and fighting with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an organization called Mediation in Motion. They're linked with UCT, where one can, and I've had this experience, I've been on the training. I mean, where facilitated mediation really does get to the bottom of a dispute with an agreement, a settlement that is binding ultimately, but everything's non-binding until such time as that agreement is actually made, where the most amazing outcomes are achieved without the huffing and the puffing and the legal fees and the time and the courts, which of course we all know is unaffordable and takes years to get matters sorted out.
Elise, thank you so much for the tip.
Very good advice. Thank you.
Is.
And something else I should mention, if the amount isn't too huge, is the Small Claims Court. They do a lot of amazing work. I think the limit is, though, 18,000 Rand. But if, say, if you lost 25,000 and were willing not to, to give up on the other, you know, the difference, it's a very good remedy for a lot of people. And I would recommend it if, you know, as a almost free solution for people who have need to go legal with something.
Elise,
against
thank
the company.
You. Yeah. Okay, thanks. And thank you for that call, Elise. A mediation in motion linked with UCT would be a good place to start for our Cape Talk listeners wanting that kind of help. We've got a question that's come in as a voice note or a comment. Let's take a listen.
Hi, Papa. Just wondering about the clause in a contract that says if you haven't collected your goods, like from a dry cleaners after 3 months, or you haven't paid your fees for storage or something for 3 months, that people can sell your goods. I know it's in a contract, but is that legal? Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for the question. Wendy, what's your perspective?
It's not specifically covered by the CPA, as far as I know, but I would the basic tenets of the Act would apply, and that would be they could never do that unless it was brought to your attention in a very tangible way when you took your goods in. It would have to be fair and reasonable, so I would say 3 months is not reasonable. It would have to be much longer than that. And before they did it, they would have to notify you by all means possible and several times what the risk was, because you can understand for some people, you know, the Act is fair on both parties. So if you've just, you know, for whatever reason, haven't bothered to go and fetch something and it's causing a problem in terms of storage or whatever else for the company, they have a right to have, you know, to do something about it. But as I say, only after all those, you know, disclosure and notifications and all those things have happened, and as long as it's reasonable. As I say, 3 months is not reasonable.
Okay, thanks for that. Hugh has been waiting on the line very patiently from Fishhook, wanting to take us back to disclaimers. Hugh, good afternoon.
Not quite disclaimers. It's a question of retail supermarkets. Don't feel obliged to put a price on a particular article if there's a barcode and if there's something on the shelf. That is fine as long as it works properly. Where there's a discrepancy, what happens, and this often happens where there are cheaper goods next to the more expensive ones, the cheaper move out, the price stays the same, and the expensive goods are then put in the same place. But in other words, are they obliged to put on a price? Now, there seems to be a conflict. If you talk to Pick and Pay managers, they say that it's not their policy, they must mark, and the staff say, the heck of the will, you rely on the barcode. Now, there seems to be a problem here in that what suits the convenience to staff isn't necessarily what suits the customer.
Interesting comment. When do we come back to supermarkets? Almost every week. I guess that's fair enough, seeing as how much time we spend in all of them.
Exactly. I'm a little confused by that, because very few of your fast-moving goods companies are still putting actual physical price tags on products. You certainly won't find it in a Pick and Pay. So all we have to rely on as consumers is the shelf price. And it does happen at times, and it would be quite difficult, if not impossible, for us, unless we had inside information, to say, well, that's done deliberately. Sometimes we have a lot of goods crammed onto shelves, and sometimes you will have a product that's sitting in front of a shelf price that the price actually applies to the product sitting next to it, and we don't realize until because we're not checking the barcodes, we don't realize, or we're not checking to see that it's the exact product. We get to the till and there's a problem. In that case, you couldn't argue that the price was wrong. In other words, it had scanned wrong. It's the price applied to a product other than the one you're wanting to buy. So you wouldn't have the right to insist on the lower price, or in some cases, as with Pick and Pay, it gets, you know, double the difference and all that kind of thing as compensation. Mm. So it's a difficult one. But the advice being, I mean, other than if you have evidence that it's been done deliberately, which would, you know, I like to think is not the case, all you can do as a consumer is to just check that the label on the shelf that it does apply to the product that you want. But it's quite an onerous thing to have to do with every item that you're picking off a shelf in a supermarket.
But it is exactly your responsibility at the end of the day to make sure that what you're putting in your trolley is actually what you thought you were buying.
Yeah. The barcode applies, the price and the barcode, it applies to another product. You can't stand your ground and say, I want this at the other product's price. Because I didn't look properly on the shelf. You're not going to win that particular battle.
Wendy, that's where we must wrap for today. As always, a fascinating show. Thanks for being with us, and we'll chat again next week.
Lovely, Pippa. Thanks.
Wendy Nola is our consumer watchdog. Consumer Talk every Wednesday between 1 and 2. Remember, you can email her if you've got a question you'd like her to pursue on consumer@nola.co.za.